by the time I was 30, I had traveled to 30 different countries. I said, you know, there is one thing that we can do something about and that impacts more animals than any other cruelty, and it is what we eat. It is factory farming.
Welcome to Follow Your Kind podcast, a show where we explore the meaning of kindness and how we can express it in our daily lives. My name is Christina, and I'm your host. All right. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Kind podcast. And I'm beyond excited, ready to jump out of my chair through the ceiling, because I have today the president of Mercy for Animals, Leah Garces. Hi, Leah.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so excited and feel absolutely privileged to have you in my apartment and be talking to you. Just so much respect for the work that you do and the person you are. And I've been stalking you everywhere.
Oh, and it's everything an honor. I learned.
Yeah. Thank you. So Leah is currently a president of Mercy for Animals as of October this year. And then before, you have decades of work that you spend in animal activism, and you have been a director in USA Division of the Compassion in the World Farming before, mm-hmm. correct?
Correct.
And have a lot of experience with working with corporations as well for animal welfare policy. So yes. You have a lot of experience yep. in that. But I would like to take a lot of steps back and kind of start at with your background and just ask you how you got into this world.
Well, I think like many people, my first love of animals sort of laid out my path for the rest of my life. And when I grew up in Florida initially, and I had ducks in my backyard, and I had the great privilege of watching them hatch, and you know, the mothers make nests, and seeing these families and dramas unfold and getting very close to the ducks. And from a very young age, I understood that these animals were sentient beings, had their own desires and wills to live, and mm-hmm. this really shaped my path. It was no question in my mind that these animals deserved a life worth living and their own path. And that led me to want to help animals. And I did a zoology degree in University of Florida. So I thought I wanted to be a vet, but very late in my degree, I was on this pre-vet path. My professor said to me, Leah, you don't seem to me to be a vet. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, vets are kind of like plumbers. They fix things that are already broken. You seem like someone who's curious about getting to the root of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yes, that's totally me. So I decided to do a master's degree instead in sustainable development and began really understanding the impact that agriculture was having on the environment and on animals and our, you know, future, in fact. And that's when I kind of really became aware of factory farming and its impact. I had been a vegetarian since I was about 15 years old, but mm-hmm. It was through this master's degree that I really understood how detrimental factory farming was, not just to animals, but to the planet and our future. And that is when I was in England when I did my master's degree. I started working for Compassion in World Farming and really fighting to end this horrific system that disregards animals as sentient beings, disregards the planet and people. And it felt like, that was what we should be focusing on. And I took a slight deviation from that when I went to work for World Animal Protection. And I spent about 7 years looking at all the ways in which human beings, frankly, inflict suffering on animals. And I ran the global campaigns and programs for that organization and saw everything from stray dogs to whaling, to bear bile farming in China, to dolphinariums, like dolphin trade. And still at the end of that, after, by the time I was 30, I had traveled to 30 different countries. I said, there is one thing that we can do something about and that impacts more animals than any other cruelty. And it is what we eat. It is factory farming. And so after about 7 years of doing that, I said, that's the only thing I want to focus on now. I really want to focus on farmed animals. And I opened up Compassion Wool Farming USA, did that for about 8 years, and then had the opportunity to be the president for Mercy for Animals, which is, you know, even more hyper-focused on not just ending factory farming, but ending the exploitation of animals and promoting a plant-based diet.
Mm-hmm. What an incredible journey. This is so amazing. And I think it's so interesting because a lot of people that I talk to, there's usually the moment where they were going one way and then there's this moment where they wake up. And it seems like you had this like deep awareness and being attuned with your feelings and being aware of the other beings and other animals from such an early age. And you seem like you were pretty confident about the direction that you were going to from the very beginning.
I do feel very lucky that I found my path, or my path found me, I'm not sure which one, very early, and I stuck to it. I didn't really deviate. I didn't try too many different. This is what I wanted to do. I feel very drawn to helping animals, and that was my cause that I was going to dedicate myself to. And I think all during my teenage years, I definitely was like had a fire, like I wanted to fight something, and I just needed to find my cause, you know. And this fit me. This was it.
Oh, this is great. How did you end up from getting your master's in Florida to going to England and living in England?
I actually got my master's in England, so okay. I did my undergrad at University of Florida, and then I really, at the time, there were not many options for doing sustainable development. It was in 1999, and I said, you know, I really want to focus on this. It was kind of a new concept, actually. And there were only three places to do it. There were two universities in Boston, and I went to Boston in March, and I thought I was going to die. It was so cold. So I was like, I'm not moving there. It was so cold. I was like, I'll never survive here. And believe it or not, England had it was a better option. And it was cheaper and faster.
Think.
Yeah. So I went there and I loved it. I loved working in England. And the animal protection movement in the UK is far more developed than what I was used to in the United States. It was further along. So I got introduced to a whole developed professional world dedicated to protecting animals, and that was really fantastic.
Wow. So we can just get right into it because I have a few specific questions that I want to talk to you about. So some of the things that stood out for me from the videos that I watched, and you're such an amazing speaker, by the way. So
you're very kind.
Talk to me about why, or maybe explain more about why do you consider the animal farming being a social justice issue?
Yeah, as I said earlier, I think that animal agriculture, first and foremost, impacts the animals, but it goes far beyond that. So it is impacting almost every aspect of our life and our future. It affects the water we drink, the air we breathe. It affects the wildlife, the habitats they live in. It's affecting communities, their connections to food and health. It's affecting health. It's affecting poverty. It's affecting, you name it, it's being affected by animal agriculture. And so the reverse of that is if we can resolve that, we can improve so many areas of life. And so, you know, I feel like it is often kind of quarantined in, oh, this is just an ethical issue. It's just do you like to eat animals or not? It's not that. It should be considered a social justice issue, and we need to really expand our understanding of it as such, because we'll come up with more solutions. We'll solve the problems because we'll expand our understanding of the problem, not to just be this narrow animal ethical issue. It really is much, much broader and bigger and more important than that.
Mm-hmm. And I also like what you said, that you said something like we're not looking at all the solutions, that's why we're not solving the problem.
Right.
Can you talk a little more about what other solutions do you think are there that people are not considering?
Yeah, I really believe in constructive solutions. So one thing is to go and point out all the problems and go, this is wrong and this is wrong. But you have to come to the table with the solutions. And if you really want to solve the problems, you actually have to talk to the people that are causing the problems or involved in the problems in the first place. And an example of that is when I worked with a factory farmer to expose what was happening on his farm. And it was through working with a chicken factory farmer who became a whistleblower, allowed me to bring a camera in, show what was actually happening on the farm, that I really thought for the first time about him, the farmer. Why was he doing this job in the first place? And I spent time with him and his family, and it was in rural North Carolina in one of the poorest counties in the state. And frankly, he wanted to just stay on the land and have this rural life, this life in the country. It was a piece of land that had been inherited five generations over, and chicken farming was the only way to stay there, and there was no other job options. So understanding that in the first place made me realize he's not an evil person. He's a person who needed to pay the bills, has three kids,
stuck in a system.
And he's stuck in the system. And if we really want to solve it, I need to help him get out of the system and provide an alternative to that. So that's an example of where we're not solving the problem because we're not thinking about that aspect of the system. There could be a lot more solutions like that if we opened our mind and tried to reach other audiences and other stakeholders and other communities. We really are very narrowly focused on, almost a very small subset of the population, and we're not talking to everybody we should be to solve the problem.
That is such a good point, and I think I find something very similar in healthcare today. So when I first started working in healthcare, I came into it with a very, very skeptical view about the resistance that there may be against a plant-based diet and nutrition and all the preventative and lifestyle medicine. And I was kind of like ready to fight and kind of walk in wary as well at the beginning. But I think what I'm learning more and more right now that the system is so complex and there are so many doctors and practitioners and just many other people who work in healthcare system and who they do not necessarily step against the plant-based nutrition and preventative medicine, but they're just stuck in their roles. And if they were given a choice or if it was easy for them, maybe they would make a different decision or maybe they would make a suggestion or if doctors had more times with patients, maybe they would talk more about diet. But because the system is just set in its way, sometimes it's just so hard to do. So it's such a good point. And taking that positive activism approach, as you said, it completely switches our perspective.
Yeah, it's a constructive approach. So instead of blaming the person for not doing better, you come to the table with the tools they need to do better. You're mm-hmm. providing the path. You're providing the tools. You're one by one providing the steps for the solution. And instead of becoming their opponent, you're becoming their enabler. And that's what you need to figure out. How can I become the enabler of everyone to move away from factory farming, from eating animals in the first place?
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. And then when it comes to companies, I watched your talk from the Compassion in World Farming. We talk about corporations and how your message was that we're actually winning in all of the policy changes that were happening recently. And it was also so cool to learn that companies, they want to have the competitive advantage and they want to make profits. And if that's what the consumer wants, they will go with that. Will you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so that was, I gave a talk at Harvard Law School about corporate wins or corporate strategies and why they're important. And really what I learned in a similar vein to working with Craig Watts, the factory farmer, is that when you sit down with companies, again, they're not necessarily these evil, big conglomerates. There's individuals there. And those individuals, if you provide the right tools and the pathways, they will work hard to find a way. And you especially can find individuals in those companies who are motivated to find those. Mm-hmm. They're either vegetarian or vegan themselves, or they really care about animals, and they know they don't want to do it this way. They just need help. And I think with what I learned from working with companies as well, really they just care about the bottom line. They're answering to their shareholders quarter to quarter. They're trying to stay competitive. They're trying to stay ahead and keep their shareholders happy. So they don't really care about continuing to sell lots of chickens. They just care about those chickens making them money. So if we can find a different way to make them money and reach their bottom line and keep their shareholders happy and make them ahead of the trends, then they will move in that direction. So I think in terms of either plant-based or animal welfare, if you can present animal welfare as either, you can say to them, look, if you do this badly, it is a great disadvantage to you. It can be a PR disaster. It is a food safety issue. It's a problem for you. It's a weight for you. It can cost you money, reputation, etc. But if you do it well, it can be a business advantage, and you can, you know, leapfrog ahead of your competitors. This is on trend with the market. And the same goes with a lot of the plant-based products. So right now, you know, it's very clear plant-based alternatives are growing very quickly in the market. And the market share mm-hmm. continues to grow. It's growing by 8% per year, which is faster than chicken right now in terms of how it's growing. And we need to continue to say to them, if you want to future-proof yourself, you really need to be taking on more plant-based options on your menus and in your shelves, because that is where the market's moving. Millennials want to eat that food. They don't want to eat tons of factory farmed meat. They just don't. You're going to be out of business if you don't stay on top of these trends. And so it's, again, like, you know, pull the tool out of the toolbox you need to convince people. And for businesses, it's not, you know, this is cruel, these are sentient beings. For businesses, it's like, you're going to go out of business. You're going to be bankrupt if you don't stay on top of this trends. Everybody wants plant-based. It's a growth market area. And all your competitors are doing it, you're going to fall behind if you don't keep up with this trend.
Right. It's speaking the language of the entity that you're speaking to.
Right.
That's such a great point. Can we talk more about the intersectionality and stepping out of the bubble?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for too long, the animal rights world and the vegan world is speaking really exclusively to either just an elite kind of group of vegans, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on in other communities, though, that is not, we wouldn't say like it's come from a animal rights perspective or a vegan perspective, but maybe it's like communities talking about health issues. So I know there's a local chef here, Chef Zhu. Do you know him?
Yes, yep. I interviewed him.
You
a few
interviewed
weeks
him.
Ago.
So Chef Zhu is doing amazing work.
Yes.
You know,
in
Atlanta communities, really reaching to underserved communities, you know, teaching them about, you know, nutrition, plant-based nutrition, the importance of it. And I mean, he's doing an amazing job just turning the place upside down and doing it. And that's the kind of communities that we're really not talking to very much. And we need to do a lot more talking to. And I think that my, you know, ambition is to really take all these little pockets and unite them because, mm-hmm. you know, I think we're much, you know, having a more diverse community, we're going to be more effective. We'll think of more solutions. We'll reach more people. So I think that there is a lot of work going on right now about that intersectionality of these different issues. You know, how can we cover these different issues at the same time. And it's, you know, it's very important. And again, we won't solve the problem unless we look at it in this way.
Are there any specific strategies that you're thinking of or methods for uniting these different communities, a through line they can go through?
Right now we're just exploring mm-hmm. kind of doing joint projects and reaching out to community leaders and thinking collectively about, you know, how can we bring all these issues together. I think mm-hmm. just the conversation itself is important right now, and having that thought in your head, you know, we have been a very isolated community for a long time, and we really need to reach out and think through all of the solutions, all of the communities, all of the problems, all the tools in the toolbox if we really want to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. The coming together piece.
Yeah, I think
that's amazing. Another topic that I want to touch on is I know that the big part of the announcement that was also that you were the first female president of the Mercy for Animals, and it seems like this also has been a trend. I know PETA's leadership is there are also women who are mm-hmm. leading that company. So can you talk more about why that is important today and kind of that shift?
Yeah, I mean, 3/4 of the employees that work in animal rights are female, but for very long periods of time, all the leadership were white men, essentially, which was just playing to the patriarchal, you know, power structure, and it was a problem. It was an issue, and But very quickly with the Me Too movement that hit the entire country, there was a rapid reconstruction of the leadership within the animal rights movement. And so you saw several leaders move up and several move out, and we have very strong female leadership now. And I was the first, you know, I'm the first female president at Mercy for Animals, but there are other great female leaders like Sharon Nunez at Animal Equality. There's mm-hmm. Erica Meyer at Compassion Over Killing. There are several other women leading the way throughout the animal rights movement, and I hope it continues to grow. The issue I think was when there wasn't a lot of female model leaders, and they weren't getting profiled by journalists. They weren't getting profiled in podcasts. So it's great you're doing this, and it was hard to get airtime. It was hard to get space, and so it just perpetuated the problem. And mm-hmm. but I think that is really strongly changing. Our awareness was, you know, abrupt and quick to act, and I feel like we are really getting closer and closer. I think there's issues around board membership, so we still need to look at boards and females on boards, and mm-hmm. also people of color on boards. There's definitely not enough of that happening, continuing always to be being aware of the makeup of our boards, the makeup of our leadership, and ensuring that we're on top of that, and not always going to the same like five white men to do the same jobs in every board and every leadership. There are so many people with so many wonderful ideas at all levels, and we need to make it that effort to look beyond our, you know, that kind of very narrow base that we usually look for.
Right. It's so invigorating and exciting to see this change and shift and participation and also acknowledgement that is happening. There's so much hope in that. Can we talk a little bit more about Mercy for Animals now? For those who don't know, can you give maybe just a brief explanation of what their organization does? And then I know you have accomplished a lot of things, but now with your presidency, maybe if there is a change in direction, or what is your vision for the journey forward?
Yeah, I mean, we're an organization that, you know, our vision is a world where all animals are respected, protected, and free to pursue their own interests. And we believe in doing that through constructing a compassionate food system. So one that both reduces the suffering of animals and ends the exploitation of animals through promoting plant-based. Mm-hmm. So that's really our core focus, and we have different pathways for trying to achieve mm-hmm. that. And it's really through either changing the law, changing company policies, or changing people's minds and capacity building of the movement itself. And we do a lot of the way we bring visuals or put pressure on a lot of these systems is through investigations. So mm-hmm. we do a lot of undercover investigations. We've done 60 undercover investigations. We actually came out with one today, our first ever, in Mexico on pig farms. We investigated a bunch of pig farms in Mexico, standard practice kind of stuff, horrific things like mutilation of piglets mm-hmm. without any anesthetic, standard practices like keeping pigs in gestation crates where they have no room to even turn around, really standard things that you don't need to dramatize. They're absolutely horrific. And so we work very hard to bear witness and bring this to the public eye and continue to do that, because without those images, people won't understand how horrible the system really is. The standard system, our standard food system that brings animals to our plate, is horrific and unacceptable. And that forms a really big backbone of who we are. We do a lot of veg outreach, trying to inform and support people in becoming vegan. But really, we measure our impact by the number of animals we reduce the suffering of, or the number of animals we've taken off of plates through institutional change, so corporate or government policies that have been achieved through our work and our pressure tactics.
Mm-hmm. And can you do you remember any of some of the numbers from the top of your head?
Well, I know each year we're aiming to get through some of, so we do a lot of work in, for example, Brazil, Mexico, and India to do local school initiatives to get animals off of plates. So mm-hmm. we aim for about, to replace about 38 million meals where we get animals off of the plate. In terms of numbers of animals with corporate agreements, in the next 3 years, we're aiming for about a billion animals to wow. have their lives improved. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly through broiler chickens. So mm-hmm. We're, you know, these are estimates, and year on year, it depends on the companies that we get to make commitments or the governments we get to sign agreements with us. And, you know, it's important work, and we do work that we can measure. We think it's very, very important to be able to measure our impact and not just say, you know, we're just doing this work, but here's the proof. Here are the agreements. We're tracking it. We're enforcing it. We're looking to make, and we're refining our methods based on that information.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think numbers are so helpful. And as you said, I mean, there maybe not as, I would imagine it's extremely hard to put a pin down as for the specific numbers, but having those goals, I think, and being able to, envision somehow the at least the proportions of the change. I think it's very important. One of the things that really stood out for me during your talk at Harvard was the way that you explained how many chickens die every single second. It was what 269 chickens are dead every single second.
Yeah.
And it's
just in this country,
just mind-boggling
right.
the amount of animals, the lives that we take, that suffer their whole life just for the pure pleasure of our taste buds.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It is crazy. And it's not, I think that the key there is people only do it. People eat animals in spite of how they're produced, not because of how they're produced and kept.
Right.
And if we can match that convenience and that taste with an alternative, they'll just do it. It's not, they're not eating animals because they're driven, you know, they have this, they want to eat chickens that are tortured.
Mm-hmm.
They're just doing it because it's easy and it's cheap and it tastes good. So all we have to do, the solution is only to come up with the alternative that tastes good, that's cheap, that's convenient, and they just find on the shelf. And we know that works because you can see that happening with milk, and you can see that happening with some of the burgers that are out now. So mm-hmm. like the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger. The Beyond Burger is a great example where they insisted that their product has to appear in the meat section. It's not, can't be in the, you know, it can be in the veg section, but it needs to be in the meat section because they found it sells seven times more often when it's next to the meat, because you go to the meat and you're like, oh, what's this? I'm going to try this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do, is match a person who's going to buy a burger and find, oh, there's this interesting product. It tastes good. It's cheaper. It's healthier. Okay, I'm going to buy it. And that's the model we need to try to look for.
Yeah. No, that's so smart. Do you have any alterations that you're hoping to make to the trajectory of Mercy for Animals, or any specific goals that you're setting for yourself and your role now?
Well, we're working on our strategic plan right now, mm-hmm. so I would say watch this space. It's going to come out around the end of February, and it will be a 3-year strategic plan mm-hmm. for the first time. We're going to launch that publicly.
Awesome. I'll be looking out for that. In terms of what are some of the things that give you hope? Because I would imagine it's important to have the fire, and it's important to have the passion, but I think it's also important with the caring and kind heart as yours is, and being exposed to this cruelty and working in this environment every day, I would imagine it's very hard. How do you keep that fire, and what gives you hope?
Well, what gives me hope is some of the technology that's now coming out, which is cell-based meat. So clean meat, cell-based meat, which is meat that is created with no slaughter. And it's cells of animals that are grown and that don't require any animal to have been harmed. So you're taking the cell of a feather of a chicken, you're growing those cells into the chicken that we eat, and then the chicken is running around next to you that the feather came from. And so no, it's slaughter-free meat. And that is happening. There are 24 companies, last time I checked, that are moving ahead and working to get to market, and that will happen in our lifetime. And I think once that happens and once that gets to scale, there's no question in my mind that that will outpace slaughtered meat. And nobody's going to want an animal that's been slaughtered and tortured and all the rest of the safety issues and the environmental issues over an animal that didn't have any of those things happen, that didn't have the environmental impact. It's a no-brainer. And that technology gives me a lot of hope. So we just kind of have to hold on till then. Mm-hmm. I think that the work we're doing, I think what also gives me hope is some of the state ballot initiatives and seeing all the public support. So we recently passed California Prop 12, which banned all cages and crates and the sale of those products in California. And before that, we did Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, it was 78% yes for that vote. And that was one of the largest percentages in the history of animal ballot initiatives. People are on our side. We just have to make it easier for them. We just have to make it easier. I'm hopeful because I do believe people don't want this. They don't. They're just busy and it's not a priority. So if we can, again, provide the tools, make it easier, be constructive, it will happen.
You're such a rock star. I cannot believe you're doing all this work, and you also have this beautiful family. You have three children, right?
I do, yes, three kids.
How do you? That is amazing.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying I do all of it well, that's for sure. I have a wonderful husband who is very supportive of my work. I think behind every successful woman is a, equal partner. So I think that is important. Yeah. I don't know. I've always done what I love. And I think that drives me. But I'm also very balanced. My family keeps me grounded and ensures that I don't work crazy hours and don't have balance and limits. I think there are natural cutoffs to my work mm-hmm. day because I have to feed my kids and get them to bed. But that actually gives my brain a break and some space that it needs. And I think that actually has amplified my impact having a family. I'm not sure that's true for everybody, but for me, it's helped create some boundaries that I otherwise might not have had.
That is so cool. Because on top of everything we just talked about, you're also like an amazing role model for having a balanced, well, as much as you can, right?
Yeah.
But balanced family life. This is so cool. We so much need more of this in this world.
Yeah. Well.
What is your family favorite, like a vegan family meal or?
Two meals that I almost make every week that are on like the demand from the kids. One is pesto, which is pesto. Yes.
Yeah.
You're looking at me like you don't know
pesto. The kids are demanding it.
Oh, yes.
That is awesome.
They love pesto because I just make a vegan pesto, which is, nutritional yeast flakes and pine nuts and olive oil and basil. And sometimes I put kale or something instead in there. And they love that. So, and that's easy to make. And, you just put it in a blender and it's like raw. So it's just like, they love it. And then with the noodles. The other one is a chickpea soup that is actually a Jamie Oliver recipe that I love. And it's like four ingredients. And it's like, celery and onions and rosemary and then chickpeas and olive oil. And like it's just cooked over 40 minutes or something and blended up. And then you put pasta with it. It's like super yummy.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. I'm into like, you get it? Like I'm into blending things. Like
I'm here.
Mush. I'm not a presentation person as anybody will. I'm not a detail person. I'm more of like it gets the nutrition to them. It tastes good. Check.
That is so fun. I just love that your kids' favorite meals are chickpea soup and pasta.
Oh, yeah.
So random, but so amazing.
Yeah. Well, we always had them eat with us and eat normal adult foods. And my middle son loves to cook. He's like wants to be a vegan chef and a farmer when he grows up. So he takes a lot of joy in helping cook. So he does a lot of the cooking.
How old is he?
He'll be 9 in January.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You have Santa's little helper.
I do. He's very helpful.
Oh, this is so cool. Well, I want to be very respectful of your time. So before, I have one more question I want to ask before we close. But before that, is there anything else, any final words of wisdom that you want to share with the listeners?
So I had a New York NYU students I spoke to recently, and they asked me for words of advice for careers. So maybe that would be useful to share.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, it was more like, how do you find the things you want to do or paths? And I had kind of three pieces, which was, the first one was, you know, find what you're good at and what you love to do. And that's the sweet spot. I'd probably add to that, and also that you can make some money from. That's also helpful. But then in order to do that, so my second piece of advice, in order to do that, you have to be prepared to try lots and lots of things and fail. Really, like, be prepared to fail and not chalk up failures, like, not treat so-called failures as failures, but chalk them up as data. It's just learning. You're just learning about what works and what doesn't work. And then the last piece was to build a really sound support system for yourself through family, friends, and self-care, because that will help you take more risks, and it will hold you steady during setbacks and allow you to, like, pick yourself back up. And I think that last piece, a lot of people don't do the self-care part. And it's really, really important for longevity in your career and success and your ability to focus in the long term.
That is amazing. Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so the name of the podcast is Follow Your Kind, and I'm very much on the same page with you that I believe that people are originally born in this world being kind. It's just we unlearn how to do that properly, or maybe sometimes we don't think through our actions. So I always like to ask, finish with a question of what kindness means to people and how they get to follow it in their daily life. So what kindness means to you?
I guess kindness, well, I like to tell people to first and foremost start with kindness to yourself. I think too often people are very hard on themselves and judge themselves very harshly, and it creates a lot of unhappiness. And if you can't be kind to yourself, you're not going to be capable of being kind to others. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where unkindness often stems from, is sort of an inconfidence in yourself or a lack of compassion towards yourself. So if people come to me and say, I'm having this terrible day, I'm so bad at my job, I can't seem to find my way. And I had somebody say to me once, and I always try to say this now to myself, is, what would you say if a friend was saying that to you? Hmm. Tell that to yourself. Try to think, what advice would you give that friend? And be kind to yourself. Treat yourself kindly. So I think kindness to yourself is important so that you can be kind to others.
That's awesome. Thank you so, so much for your time. Thank you for your advice. I'm looking forward to all the amazing things that will be coming out, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
Thank you. For more information, you can go to followyourkind.com or follow me on Instagram at kindchristina. Please also subscribe to the show and give me a good review. Thanks for stopping by.